In the early 1990s, I had a job in the anatomy department of my medical school in Edinburgh. And at the entrance hung a reproduction of Rembrandt's famous The Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Toulpe. The top floor there was a museum filled with curiosities. There was death masks, cabinets of skulls, a two-headed lamb, a unicorn horn. The collection up there was a rich one, gathered over 400 years, and the items on display in the upper chambers of the building were only a fraction of what the basement held. And in the course of my work, I often had cause to descend there, where catacombs of corridors extended under the city itself, each one piled high with boxes of bones. Giraffe bones, whale bones, human bones, and shelves loaded with body parts in formalin. Anatomizing the human body filled me with a stunned sense of glory. I was perpetually astonished by just how intricate, finely calibrated, and close-packed is the physiological machinery that keeps us alive. On the walls of the dissection room where I worked were a reproduction engravings of Vesalius's masterpiece of utilitarian anatomy on the fabric of the human body, drawn from dissections he made as the professor of anatomy in Padua. And Vesalius overturned two millennia of received knowledge about the body by describing what he saw rather than what all the textbooks told him he should see. And for that, he's perhaps one of the founders of the materialist medicine that we know today, an approach that has brought a wealth of benefits but has also brought us risks. A few decades after Vesalius taught in Padua, a young Londoner called Thomas Brown came to the city. He was on a grand tour of the continent's medical schools then. Montpellier was then famous for botany. Padua was famous for its anatomy. Leiden, where there was an innovation called bedside teaching, which was just coming into vogue. And Brown was a very pious man, but he was also a curious one. He was a polymath, a natural philosopher, a restless seeker. He was a wordsmith and an enthusiast. And I recently wrote a short, odd, unorthodox biography of him. I'm a great enthusiast of Thomas Brown, not least for his love of anatomy, of which he wrote, "I that have examined the parts of man and know upon what tender filaments that fabric hangs do wonder that we are not always sick, and considering the thousand doors that lead to death do thank my God that we can die but once." One of the greatest and most resonant themes of Brown's books is mortality and how we can make peace with the knowledge of certain oblivion when the elemental constituents of our bodies will be dispersed and take up a more universal circuit in the bodies of other living things. "But the iniquity of oblivion blindly scatters her poppy," Brown wrote, "and deals with the memory of men without distinction to merit of perpetuity." Of the shortness of our bodily lives, he wrote, "There is no antidote against the opium of time, which temporally considers all things. Our fathers find their graves in our short memories, and sadly tell us how we may be buried in our survivors." Now, doctors and nurses, as I don't need to tell this audience, get accustomed very quickly in their careers to the frailty and the vulnerability of the body, to the workings of the opium of time. But their work also grants familiarity with other aspects of our humanity. Our compassion and our love, our ambitions and our aspirations. The daily work of medicine is to meet people in extremis. It's emotionally exhausting, but it's also uplifting. We work with death, we work to oppose death, but we also work to ease suffering and restore life. And this idea of unity of opposites of life and death, it must go back to the very origins of human thought, to the first hominid who realized that eating to live must necessarily involve killing. Thomas Mann famously took that tension even further in The Magic Mountain when he described life as the half-sweet, half-painful balancing or scarcely balancing in this restricted and feverish process of decay and renewal upon the point of existence. So for Thomas Mann, we're always hovering on the edge of being just matter, or what is called, for good reason, mortal remains. Now, Brown lived at a balanced pivotal point between the old medieval medicine of alchemy and the new developing world of science. He was a contemporary of Harvey, who discovered the circulation of the blood, and of Willis, who defined the anatomy of the brain. But Brown, in his books, is always reminding us of something that the best clinicians know. The illness is so much more than the matter of the body gone awry. Illness is also about beliefs and expectations and what we might call mind or spirit. And for that, we have to think bigger, to what Brown named that celestial part within us. For Brown, that came from God, but we might also think of it as human potential and human possibility of imagination, the attributes that our own age deems make us distinct from the animals. Life is a pure flame, he said, and we live by an invisible sun within us. Just as the sun animates the earth, each of us has a spark of something else that animates all that carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, which, as you'll remember, was forged in the bursts of long-dead stars. Now, as a GP, spending so much time at the bedsides of the sick and the dying, I find it sharpens the mind to awareness of the gift of life. And I've sat beside many deathbeds, and I've never heard anyone say yet that they wish they'd spent more time at the office. Sickness has a habit of reframing our priorities. And if there are any gifts of the atrocious years of the pandemic for me, I think they're this: that society as a whole has become more aware of the fragility of the body and the fragility of our way of life. Some people have become more tolerant and understanding of illness, and many people have reconfigured their priorities. We've seen how easily everything can be disrupted by a tiny, self-reproducing piece of viral protein 100 nanometers across. So a million coronaviruses could dance on the head of a pin. And they changed the world. In ITU departments and COVID wards up and down the country, clinicians helped the dying. They helped them communicate with their loved ones despite grueling rotas, not enough PPE, and the very poor example of our politicians. And GPs like me, who normally spend about a third of our time talking to our patients about mental health, found that during lockdowns that doubled, at least. The number of people I ended up speaking to with anxiety, intractable insomnia, who began self-harming, who became deeply paranoid, all those changes were brought by the virus and by the damaging effects of the necessary lockdowns. I think we learned very much how we missed being able to come together to laugh, touch, and embrace one another when suddenly it became a crime to do just that. We learned what really matters. And I learned that I never want to go back to 2020. In an account... That's a slow starter, that one. In an account of the pandemic seen from the perspective of general practice, I wrote that we've got a unique opportunity now, in my view, being largely squandered, to build back better with reconfigured priorities. I saw every day how the young paid a disproportionate price for the lockdowns, and we're failing so far to make it up to them. For a year or so, we solved homelessness. Now people are all back on the streets. For months, they were clapping on the doorsteps, and now NHS workers are being criticised and offered derisory pay increases. But I like to think that there are some silver linings of the pandemic. We all know someone who's struggled with recovery from COVID or who has become anxious in public after so long shuttered away. And as a society, I like to think or hope that we've become more accepting of the need to respect the process of recovery and make time for convalescence. Recovery isn't something that we get taught at medical school, because all the textbooks assume that once a crisis is over, the body and mind find ways to heal themselves. But the thousands of patients I've met and supported over many years of practice, I qualified in 1999, so yeah, 24 years, they've taught me that medicine actually is very limited in its power, and that we need to approach recovery, convalescence, with humility. We need to learn a new language of the body and mind, and that it's an act, and like all actions, it takes effort and it takes perseverance. That we need to learn self-compassion, which is a virtue much neglected in our society, and that in situations where bodily cure is impossible, it's still possible to recover in the sense of building towards a life of greater autonomy and greater dignity. They've taught me that sometimes the simplest things are the most helpful. Things like fresh air, natural settings, companionship, a healthy diet, things that were in the textbook of Florence Nightingale. For some people, recovery feels like a game of snakes and ladders, and just when they feel they're getting somewhere, they land on a snake and slide all the way back to the beginning again. But the truth is that on our many journeys of recovery, we have more than dice to guide us, because every journey up and down the board teaches us triggers to avoid and strategies that will help us better next time. For Thomas Brown, the world was charged with wonders, wonders that he took as evidence of the munificence of God. And he believed that we human beings are an inextricable part of that world, that we are the bridge that joins matter and spirit, which brings me to the idea of recovery, not just for us as human beings and for how we might do it better, but also how we might begin to enact a new ethic of recovery for the planet. The balance that keeps our bodies in health is fragile. So too, it's becoming increasingly clear, is the balance of planetary health. Brown thought we have a responsibility to care for what he thought of as God's creation, and I'm convinced he would be saddened by the carelessness with which so far we despoil sky, soil, sea, and everything around us that sustains us. The lack of enthusiasm, too, among our politicians to enact legislation to protect it. The earth is a point, he wrote, not only in respect of the heavens above us, but of that heavenly and celestial part within us. That mass of flesh that circumscribes me limits not my mind. As an anatomist, I was stunned by a glorious sense of wonder at the complexity of matter, of the matter of ourselves, at the blunt physical reality of our bodies. But we're so much more even than that glorious arrangement of atoms, and our potential is so much greater still. All of us are but a mass of flesh, and the celestial part of us, I think, the part of us that ranges beyond the body, has yet to find its limits, because there are a great many paths towards human flourishing that remain entirely unexplored. Thank you.